You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Jonathan Capehart, in today for Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. Ari Berman, a senior contributing writer at The Nation and author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America, has written extensively about the impact of the Supreme Court's decision to gut the Voting Rights Act, which led to Republican lawmakers across the country imposing new voting restrictions. The impact of the Shelby County versus Holder decision has been a systematic disenfranchisement of thousands of minorities. Ari joins us today to discuss his ongoing investigation of mass voter disenfranchisement in Wisconsin. Ari, welcome.
Hey, Jonathan. Thank you for having me.
So in June of 2013, the Supreme Court delivered their decision in Shelby County versus Holder. Can you just remind us of what was at stake in that decision?
So what the Supreme Court ruled in the 2013 decision, Shelby County versus Holder, was that those states with the longest histories of discrimination no longer had to approve their voting changes with the federal government under the Voting Rights Act. That applied to most of the South and some other parts of the country as well, including a few counties right here in New York City. But basically, that one part of the Voting Rights Act had blocked 3,000 discriminatory voting changes from 1965 to 2013. So when those states like Georgia and Alabama and Mississippi and North Carolina no longer have to approve their voting changes with the federal government, that decision really opened the floodgates to new voter suppression efforts.
And so if I remember correctly, that means 5 of 10 states with the highest black turnout in 2008 have passed restrictive voting laws after this decision.
So what happened was states had already begun trying to pass restrictive voting laws following President Obama's election. And these efforts got a green light after the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act. So you had laws that were blocked previously, like Texas's voter ID law, where you could vote with a gun permit but not a student ID. Those laws that were blocked were allowed to go into effect. Then states began to pass more sweeping voting restrictions. So North Carolina, for example, just a month after the Shelby County decision, didn't just pass voter ID, but they cut back on early voting. They eliminated same-day voter registration. They eliminated out-of-precinct voting. They eliminated pre-registration for 16 and 17-year-olds. That law has been subsequently struck down by the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals for targeting black voters with, quote, almost surgical precision. But nonetheless, that law would have never seen the light of day had the Supreme Court not have gutted the Voting Rights Act.
So then what's the rationale? So you had the Voting Rights Act there to keep all these folks in check and force them to come to the government, to the Department of Justice, right?
Or the federal courts.
Or the federal courts to make sure that the changes are not discriminatory. The law is gutted. And now all these states decide that they need to restrict voting. Was there some blanket rationale for trying to do this, or did they each have some specific reason for why they thought they needed to impose such restrictions?
So first off, let's talk about Chief Justice John Roberts, what he wanted to do. So the rationale that the Supreme Court's 5-4 conservative majority had was that the Voting Rights Act had not changed since 1965, but the country had changed immeasurably, meaning that the country had made all of this progress partly as a result of the Voting Rights Act since it was passed in 1965, but the Voting Rights Act was still requiring states to approve their voting changes as if nothing had changed. The states themselves really had kind of a one-size-fits-all description for what they wanted to do, which was voter fraud. Basically, whether it was Texas or North Carolina or Georgia or Wisconsin, they all said there's been this rampant voter fraud and we need to pass these new voting restrictions to crack down on it. The problem is that when it came time to present cases of voter impersonation in particular in court, they didn't present any. So that leads me to believe that this was a manufactured crisis, that they talked about voter fraud as the way to build support for these new restrictions, but it was always about something else, which was about making it harder for people of color and Democratic-leaning voters to participate in the political process.
So they make the claim of voter fraud, get the state to pass these laws, but in no way did they have to or feel compelled to present any kind of evidence whatsoever to push this through?
Well, it's really amazing because when there were all of these federal court trials, that would be the time to present your best evidence in court. And these states, whether it was Texas or North Carolina or Wisconsin, couldn't find any evidence of voter impersonation to justify things like strict voter ID laws. So that's why I don't believe this was ever about voter fraud. I think voter fraud was a pretext for a political agenda of trying to disenfranchise your political opponents.
Mm-hmm. Now, can you walk us through the range of voter restrictions and how they are targeted to, for instance, African-Americans, for instance, souls to the polls?
Yeah. So everyone thinks of voter ID, and that's one part of the restrictions, the fact that you need strict forms of government-issued ID to cast a ballot in about a dozen states now, when you didn't need – no states required this before 2005. But there's other things as well that you mentioned, things like cutting early voting or making it harder to register to vote. And we saw this clearly in North Carolina. So North Carolina cut early voting and eliminated voting on the Sunday before the election, when black churches hold souls to the polls voter mobilization drives, which are very effective. And the federal court in North Carolina asked the state, why did you cut Sunday voting? And the state said, well, it was used by some counties more than others. And the court said, OK, well, which counties was it used in? And the state said, well, it was used in counties with a higher African-American population that had more Democratic voters.
And wait, they like just flat out said it.
They flat out said it. And the court said in response to this, you just admitted that you were disenfranchising people based on their race and their party. And they called the evidence of eliminating Sunday voting in North Carolina as close to a smoking gun as you'll see in modern times.
I'm sorry. I'm just flabbergasted at the sort of gall of states, and particularly certain officials. Wasn't there an elected official in Pennsylvania who said in an interview, like, this, you know, we did early voting and that's going to give the state to, I think at the time, Mitt Romney, who was a Republican nominee back in 2012. I mean, there are people who are pretty clear about the intent of this, and no shame at all about disenfranchising people their right to vote.
We've heard this repeatedly. We heard, as you mentioned, in Pennsylvania in 2012, Republicans say that the voter ID law was going to help Mitt Romney win that election. It didn't end up having that effect, partly because it was blocked in court. We've heard Republicans in Wisconsin say the same thing. We've even seen, after courts have struck down these laws, Republicans keep pushing for them. So in North Carolina, they reinstated days of early voting. And then the Republican Party chairman in North Carolina urged Republican officials to further cut early voting, basically violating the court order. And he said specifically things like, you shouldn't have polling places on college campuses because college students already have enough opportunities to vote. I mean, it was so blatant, the kind of things he was talking about, violating both the letter and the spirit of the court decisions that reinstated voting rights.
So let's talk specifically about Wisconsin. You've been doing an ongoing investigation of Wisconsin. Wisconsin is systematically failing to provide the photo IDs required to vote in November. And you found that Wisconsin's laws are disenfranchising black voters. How exactly is Wisconsin doing this?
So what the federal courts found was that 300,000 registered voters in Wisconsin, which is 9% of the electorate, don't have strict forms of ID that are now required to vote in Wisconsin for the first time in 2016. That law was blocked for many years by multiple courts after it was passed in 2011, but it was put into effect by a panel of Republican judges in 2014, including one judge who was on Donald Trump's short list for the Supreme Court. So basically, three very conservative Republicans put this voter ID law into effect. Then it was subsequently narrowed by the federal courts, who said to Wisconsin, if this law is going to be in effect, you have to make sure that everyone who wants to get an ID can get one. And the state said, no problem, no problem. We're doing that. Anyone who needs what they called a certificate for voting will get one within 6 business days. Mm-hmm. Well, I went to Wisconsin. I got recordings from the DMV from a group called Vote Riders, which helps people get voter IDs. And I talked to different black voters that had been to the DMV, and they had been turned away without the ID they needed, even though they had brought multiple forms of documentation. And we found that this was widespread. Vote Riders sent volunteers to DMVs all across the state, and they were given inaccurate or misleading info. They were not given the IDs they needed to vote in November.
And one of those people you met was Zach Moore, a 34-year-old black man who moved from Chicago to Madison last year, and he really wants to vote, even though he's currently homeless. Why is he having trouble getting a voter ID?
So his problem was that he had an Illinois driver's license, he had a social security card, and he had proof of Wisconsin residency, but he did not have his birth certificate. His birth certificate was back in Chicago. It was misplaced by his sister. Believe it or not, most people don't usually know where their birth certificates are.
I don't know where mine is. Do you know where yours is?
I know where mine is only because I got married out of the country, but that was the first time I knew where it was.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically the problem is that the DMV said he needed a birth certificate to be able to get a photo ID for voting, which is not true. He doesn't need to have his birth certificate. But this is the kind of thing we're seeing over and over in Wisconsin.
Is that Zach Moore is, if I remember the recording right, was he the one where there were two different DMV people, or is that another person that I'm thinking of?
Yeah, he talked to three different people at the DMV, and they all gave him inaccurate information.
Mm-hmm.
One person said he should go back to Illinois to get his birth certificate, even though he didn't know where his birth certificate was. He didn't need it. And third, he was homeless. He doesn't have any money to go back to Chicago to get this thing that he doesn't know where it is. The other problem was that he was specifically told that it would take, even if he was able to get an ID for voting, that it would take 6 to 8 weeks. And this was in late September, meaning if it took 8 weeks to get an ID, the election would be over.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that without a birth certificate, Mr. Moore, he would have the option of entering what the state calls the ID petition process. Now, how does that work?
Well, basically, how this process works is that Wisconsin says that they will basically, if you don't have a birth certificate, they will verify your information from another state. But nobody knows about this process. And it's just come out in federal court that the DMV doesn't even understand this process. So basically, the state of Wisconsin was making all of these promises in court about people getting IDs, but their own employees, the people that were administering the program at the DMV, had no idea how this worked, which led to many, many voters being confused and turned away.
Voters being confused, DMV folks. And the recording that I was thinking of is the one that involves Molly McGrath was the national campaign coordinator for voting rights, and she's the one who went with some folks, and she asks in this recording, if you initiate the petition process, do you get an ID for voting? And there are two DMV employees responding. DMV employee one says, no, you don't get anything. The second employee says, no, you don't get anything right away. And then Molly says, I thought you could get an ID. Like the sign says over there, no birth certificate, no problem. You can get an ID to vote. And then a third DMV employee says, you can, it just takes time.
I mean, it's unbelievable, as you mentioned it, and it's even more ridiculous when you actually listen to the recording. But as you mentioned, there's a sign right up there that says no birth certificate, no problem. And they're telling this guy that he needs a birth certificate to be able to get an ID for voting. So they're violating the own sign that's on their wall. They're violating the court order. But more importantly, they're violating people's constitutional rights.
Mm-hmm.
That people are being disenfranchised for no good reason in Wisconsin. Even when they know all the steps they should take to get an ID, they're still not getting them.
So I want to ask you about, there's a woman you write about, I think in your most recent column, but I should tell people, I'm Jonathan Capehart, sitting in for Leonard Lopate on WNYC, WNYC.org, and we're speaking with Ari Berman, senior contributing writer at The Nation. He's also the author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America, and he's at The Nation continuing to write about the problems in Wisconsin, and in that state, they're sort of systematically failing to provide the photo IDs required to vote in November. And at the start of the piece that I think it's the most recent piece you wrote, it's a woman who was born. She was born in one country to parents from another country, and then moved to the United States when she was very young. She's a naturalized citizen. She's been voting in. She moved to Wisconsin when she was older, and had been voting for years. And now with these changes, she no longer can vote. Talk about her story. Fill in the details
yes.
that I can't spout at the, off the top
so
of my
the latest
head.
Piece I wrote was about a woman named Sharda who was born in Ireland to Indian parents and came to the U.S. When she was 6 weeks old. And she became a U.S. citizen at 8. And so she's voted in every election since she was 18. She's never had any problems voting. She moved from Illinois to Wisconsin in 2013, and she voted without problems before this voter ID law went into effect. Then what happened is she realized she didn't have a Wisconsin ID. She only had an Illinois driver's license. And when she went to get a photo ID for voting, she was told, well, you need a copy again of your birth certificate. The problem is she wasn't born in the U.S., so her birth certificate didn't work. They said, you need your naturalization papers, which she had never needed in her entire life after living in America for over 40 years. She asked her father, who moved from India to Ireland to the U.S., where are my naturalization papers? He didn't know where they were. So she called the INS, and they said it would cost $345 for her to get her naturalization papers, and it would take 2 years, up to 2 years, for her to get these papers just to be able to vote in Wisconsin. So she's in a situation where she's hopefully going to be able to get her expired passport renewed. But based on what the DMV and the INS told her, it would cost her $345 and up to 2 years to be able to vote in Wisconsin after she's been voting her entire life and she's been a U.S. citizen since age 8.
Money and time, two big roadblocks to her exercising her right to vote. I'm speaking with Ari Berman about voter disenfranchisement. Ari is a senior contributing writer for The Nation magazine and a reporting fellow at The Nation Institute. We're discussing his latest article called Wisconsin is Systematically Failing to Provide the Photo IDs Required to Vote in November. We'll hear more from Ari after a break. I'm Jonathan Capehart. In today for Leonard Lopate, this is WNYC and WNYC.org. And we'll be right back after a break. Jonathan Capehart sitting in today for Leonard Lopate, and was speaking with Ari Berman, a senior contributing writer at The Nation. And we're talking about voter disenfranchisement in Wisconsin in particular, but nationwide. We were talking about a naturalized citizen who is having trouble after years being able to vote in Wisconsin, now suddenly can't vote in Wisconsin. And another person who you highlighted, Ari, in a recent article is Claudel Boyd. Talk about Claudel.
Claudel Boyd was someone who moved from Illinois to Wisconsin. He wanted to get a Wisconsin ID for voting. His birth certificate, he actually had a copy of his birth certificate. The problem was one letter was misspelled on his birth certificate because they misread his mother's cursive when he was born. So his name was spelled, instead of Claudel, his name was spelled Clardell on his birth certificate. And the Wisconsin issued him a driver's license. The problem is that the license he was issued, or they issued him a state ID card, I should say. The state ID card he was issued didn't have his right name. It had the name on his birth certificate, but that's not the name he's used his entire life. So he said, if I vote in my wrong name, this could be a felony because I'm voting in the name of somebody else. That's not actually me. So he went to go try to change his information. All his other documents, his Social Security card, his Medicare card, his Illinois ID, all have his correct name as Claudel. But the DMV would not change his information. So basically, he's stuck either without the correct ID for voting or voting in a name that's not actually his name. Those are the options that the Wisconsin DMV gave him.
Okay, this is ridiculous. So the United States government, through the Social Security Administration, has his name correctly spelled, and the DMV in Wisconsin won't accept a federal document with his correct spelling as a reason to change, to give him an ID card with his correct spelling.
Yes, because there's one letter misspelled on his birth certificate.
I mean, okay.
This has reached Kafkaesque.
Right, and this is one of the. I mean, people hate government. I mean, that's a prime example of government not working for you.
Well, and this is the whole irony here, is that you have Republicans and conservatives that rail all the time about big ineffective government. Then they have now just put the DMV in charge of voting and created a huge expansion of red tape bureaucracy for no reason when it comes to voter ID laws.
And there are people who don't like the DMV just in their regular functions. But that's a whole other conversation, and that's not why you're here. So why don't we talk about, it's not just African-Americans who are being disenfranchised. It's also young people, but it's also Latinos. Talk about what's happening in Wisconsin and nationwide in terms of keeping Latinos from the ballot box.
So that's true. I mean, I think these voting restrictions, broadly speaking, tend to hit Democratic-leaning voters. And I think they hit African-Americans most directly because they are both the strongest base of the Democratic Party. but they're also historically disenfranchised. But Latinos are also a group that is identifying more strongly with the Democratic Party and has been demonized very harshly in Republican circles. So I did another article recently for The Nation about Texas's voter registration laws. And Texas is one of the hardest states in the country to register voters. If you want to lead a voter registration drive in Texas, for example, you actually have to be deputized by the county at a training that takes place once a month or less. And then you can only register people from your own county. So let's say you live in San Antonio and you want to register voters outside a San Antonio Spurs basketball game. You have to be deputized in San Antonio to do that, and you can't register anyone from Houston, from Dallas, from any other city outside San Antonio, which means it's impossible to do a statewide voter registration drive in Texas. The big picture here is that Texas has 3 million unregistered voters, 2.2 million of whom are Latino. So you look at a situation where not just Texas's voter registration laws, but Texas's voter ID laws, they're specifically aimed at making it harder for Latinos, for African Americans to be able to register, to be able to vote. And what we're seeing is this really is evidence of a rigged system. It's funny how Donald Trump talks all the time about the system being rigged. But you go to a place like Texas and you see that there are 2.2 million unregistered Latinos. If they were registered and if they were voting, Texas would be a dramatically different state. It would be a purple state. Mm-hmm. But basically, it's been set up in such a way that the voting laws are so difficult that the state's political power is not reflective of its demographics.
So you wrote about, speaking of Texas, you wrote about Elizabeth Golar, who was born in Jim Crow, North Carolina, and she moved to Texas. Why is she having trouble being able to vote at the age of 60?
Well, this is a woman, again, who did not have access to her birth certificate. I mean, what we're seeing, particularly in lots of southern states, is that there are women who are born at home in the segregated South to midwives, and they never had birth certificates to begin with. And they've never had any problems voting. But basically, because of these voter ID laws, whether it's in Texas or Wisconsin, they're being asked for documentation that they don't actually have. They were never given things like birth certificates. So they're in a situation where to try to prove their identity, Elizabeth Golar, this woman in Texas, had to hire a lawyer. They had to contact the state of Louisiana to confirm other ways that she'd be able to vote. And you just think about the fact that this is someone who was born during Jim Crow, who experienced times when African Americans couldn't vote, had subsequently voted for all of these years, and now is told at 60 years old, you can't vote anymore. And she said she felt like the vote was being taken away from her and it wasn't right.
But she was willing, even at her age and the expense of hiring a lawyer, is fighting hard to keep her right to vote.
To keep the right to vote. And, you know, people feel very passionate about this issue. People take voting very, very seriously, particularly people that at one time were prevented from voting. And I've seen this over and over in my reporting, that those people who remember the days of Jim Crow, when African Americans and others couldn't vote, they are often the most determined to still be able to vote. I just think it's really, really, really unfortunate that as a country, we're doing this again, that we had a period for many, many years when lots of people couldn't vote. The Voting Rights Act of 1965 was meant to remedy that situation by giving the franchise to millions of people. And now we're once again seeing a systematic effort to roll the Voting Rights Act back and to make it harder for people to vote across the country.
So we've talked about Wisconsin. We've talked about Texas. Let's talk about Alabama. What about the DMV closures in Alabama? And isn't that disenfranchising the poor, elderly, disabled, African-Americans, you name it?
Well, yeah, this was crazy. I mean, basically what happened was Alabama passed a strict voter ID law. The place where you usually go to get the ID you need is the DMV. Then they closed 31 DMVs in counties. They closed DMVs in 31 counties across the state, including almost all the counties that had a majority Black population. So they basically said, okay, you need this ID to be able to vote, but guess what? We're going to close the office where you go to get that. And by the way, it's going to be in majority Black counties across the state. So this was pretty transparent what Alabama was trying to do. They subsequently said those offices will be open now one day a month. But this is really this is honestly the kind of thing you saw in the Jim Crow South. Like in Selma, Alabama, which was the focal point of the voting rights struggle, where only 2% of African Americans were registered to vote before the Voting Rights Act was passed. The voter registration offices in Alabama were only open 2 days a month. And that was one of many ways, in addition to things like poll taxes and literacy tests, that African Americans were prevented from voting. You just couldn't even have access to the voter registration offices.
So in the, I believe it's the Shelby County versus Holder decision, it was Chief Justice Roberts who argued in his opinion that, quote, the country has changed. Is that also the same decision where he said, in essence, racism is gone? Is that the same decision or a different one?
Well, basically, this decision was fraught for a lot of different reasons. First off, during the oral arguments in the Voting Rights Act case, the late Justice Scalia said the Voting Rights Act had led to a perpetuation of racial entitlement. So that really got things rolling in terms of the outrageous statements that a law that was meant to remedy centuries of injustice had somehow been transformed into a racial entitlement. Really was an outrageous statement. Mm-hmm. Then in Chief Justice John Roberts' opinion, he basically said that voting discrimination was a thing of the past. He didn't say quite so clearly racism is over. But it's amazing to first read that decision in light of all of the voter suppression that's happened after, but just to read the decision in light of everything that's happened with race in this country, mm-hmm. with all of the police shootings. Remember, this happened before Ferguson and Baltimore and Eric Garner and North Carolina and on and on mm-hmm. and on. And so I think there was just a really naive view. I think basically Chief Justice Roberts was cherry picking the evidence. He was looking at all the progress that had been made since 1965, but ignoring all of the barriers to voting and all other aspects of life that meant that race was still very prevalent in our society.
I'm Jonathan Capehart, sitting in for Leonard Lopate, and I'm speaking with Ari Berman, a senior contributing writer at The Nation, and we're talking about efforts around the country, specifically in Wisconsin, but around the country to disenfranchise voters at the ballot box. You know, we were just talking about Chief Justice Roberts and his sort of cherry-picking evidence in terms of coming down to this decision in Shelby County versus Holder that gutted the Voting Rights Act. And, you know, we were talking before about this decision coming down before the wave of racial incidents that this country has been living through for at least the last 2 years. It's seeming a nonstop pace. And now we have a presidential candidate on the stump in the he's been doing it for a while, but definitely within the last 7 days, 14 days, saying to his supporters, you know, need you to like keep an eye out, be watchful in certain areas on election day. What does that kind of rhetoric do or play into this environment that's out there that makes these voter ID laws and I'll just say voter suppression efforts, it sort of adds to the weight of what's happening?
Well, absolutely. I mean, Trump is pouring gasoline all over the place and then throwing the match out to light it with his comments about rigged elections. And what we're seeing is every time Trump starts to go down in the polls, if he even acknowledges it, he starts talking about the fact that the election is going to be stolen for him. And he's using increasingly revealing language. So he's saying that you need to monitor the polls in certain communities, in certain areas. And everyone knows what I'm talking about. He's saying that illegal immigrants are coming over the border to be able to vote. And he's basically creating the situation where people of color are viewed as a threat in all phases of life, but particularly when it comes to voting. Mm-hmm. And if you look at, he's saying these at basically rallies where his supporters are all white. And he's talking about whether it's Latinos or African Americans who he believes are going to cheat at the polls. And so I believe, number one, that there's a potential for real intimidation and even maybe violence at polling places because of his rhetoric. I believe that, two, he's giving his supporters a completely skewed perspective on the American electorate, mm-hmm. that basically voter fraud is an exceedingly rare problem when it comes to American elections. People are not voting 10 times in this country. And if they are, they're getting caught. But nonetheless, Trump supporters believe that this is happening on an ongoing basis and that only Democrats do it. And the third thing is that he is then laying the groundwork to support more restrictive voting laws. So obviously, if you believe that all of these illegal immigrants are coming over to the border to vote, or all of these African Americans are voting 10 times in Philadelphia, well, certainly you're going to support things like voter ID laws and making it harder to register to vote and giving people less time to be able to vote. Mm-hmm. This is exactly what happened with Acorn after 2008, which is that there were all of these crazy accusations made. And then you start to see all of these states, whether it's Texas or Wisconsin or Pennsylvania, begin to pass more sweeping voting restrictions.
But when Donald Trump says to people, you know, be mindful of certain areas and things like that, isn't it illegal for just regular old citizens to monitor the polls? And if you know, what's law enforcement doing to basically ensure a safe and fair election?
So the laws for poll workers vary, poll watchers vary in different states. One of the things that Trump did in Pennsylvania was say that law enforcement had to monitor the polls. And that is illegal. That is illegal in Pennsylvania and in other states. Law enforcement cannot be brought in as basically vigilante poll watchers. And not only is Trump calling for poll watchers, which every presidential campaign has, but if you click on a link to his website, it says he's calling for poll watchers to, quote, stop crooked Hillary from rigging the election. So he's basically saying that one candidate's going to be stealing the vote, as opposed to just doing the poll watching that's already done by presidential candidates. So, I mean, this is so unbelievably alarming. And I think both the Justice Department, state's attorney's offices, nonpartisan groups that run the Election Protection Coalition, the Democratic Party, everyone needs to be incredibly vigilant to make sure that people aren't intimidated out of voting and that there isn't racial profiling at the polls on Election Day or the run-up to Election Day.
We just have less than a minute left, but I would love your thoughts on this, and it's this observation. This is the first election, presidential election, in 50 years without the full protections of the Voting Rights Act.
Yeah, and I mean, that's very alarming, and we're seeing the impact, whether it's in Texas or Wisconsin, that states across the country are making it harder to vote, that Donald Trump is really inflaming these efforts with his rigged election talk. And so I think, you know, everyone has to be very vigilant to make sure that history doesn't repeat itself here.
And what should people do on Election Day if they do see intimidation? Is there anyone they can turn to say, look what's happening over here, something must be done?
The best place to call is the National Election Protection Coalition, which is 866 Our Vote. And that is nonpartisan, and they have people on the ground in every state, and they can help you. I mean, and if there are criminal things, they can refer that to the state's attorneys and other people, but they would be the people that I would initially suggest to call.
And you mentioned state's attorneys before, and you mentioned it again. What about people who live in states where the state attorney might be a Republican and in a state that's pushing these voter ID laws in the first place?
Well, maybe they could get help from the National Justice Department. I mean, you'd like to think it's not going to get to this. But I think that people need to go in prepared that people might either try to prevent them voting beforehand or challenge their right to vote on Election Day.
I've been speaking with Ari Berman, who's a senior contributing writer for The Nation magazine and a reporting fellow at The Nation Institute. We posted a link to his latest article, Wisconsin is Systematically Failing to Provide the Photo IDs Required to Vote in November, on our show page at wnyc.org/lowpaid. Ari, thanks for joining us
today.
Great
to see you. Thank you, Jonathan.